You're listening to Psych Talk.
On this hour, you're listening to Psych Talk, and I'm your host, Jose Dras Lopez. 2 weeks ago, we asked, what causes the conscious mind? Why do we have subjective experiences of colors, smells, and feelings instead of being blank like a machine? That conversation on consciousness got a strong response online. Listeners asked us to dig deeper. Well, today we're doing just that. With us in the studio is Craig Weinberg. He blogs about consciousness at multisenserealism.com, among other blogs, and he was recently invited to present his theory at the Porta Science of Consciousness Conference in Tucson, Arizona. We also have a second guest to join the discussion today. Stephen P. King has joined us over the phone to contribute his insights on time, consciousness, and philosophy. Stephen is a lifelong autodidact who is part of a budding online community of discussion groups that tackle the big philosophical questions. So thanks to both of you for being here.
Thanks. It's great to be back.
And Stephen, you still with us?
Yes, I'm here.
I'm going to start with Craig a little bit, Stephen, but we'll let you jump in whenever you're ready or whenever we have a question for you. With Craig, my question is, let's lay out the main schools of thought on consciousness and be a little more clear about what the traditional differences are among different schools. For example, I'll get it started and then you cut in when my knowledge begins to fade. We have a sort of metaphysics or physics of the world, of the universe, that's necessary to explain where consciousness fits in. I'd love if we could just talk about philosophy of mind, just talk about our own, you know, the aroma and the hazel of coffee, but we need to have some theory of what's out there in order to explain what's in here. We have to contend with maybe some kind of monism, which is this idea that the universe has one fundamental substance or reality and that everything's a property of it or a reflection of it. And that might mean a materialism, which is sort of the usual scientific view where you have atoms bouncing around and then combining with laws of physics to lead to biology and life and everything else. And by that view, consciousness is somehow just a property of physical interactions, some kind of functional relationship. And then on the opposite side of materialism, we have another type of monism of just a one substance view called idealism, sometimes called phenomenalism, mentalistic monism. And that's just the view that really the most important fundamental property of the universe is mentality or conscious experience and perception. And that's really what everything is made of. And without that, there would be no universe. And that's more, my two guests today have more of that sort of view. But there's also combinations of these materialism and idealism that might be called dualisms and even pluralisms, where they're just many different types of substances. And so we'll try to explore today. We're trying to try to avoid contradicting ourselves or saying something ridiculous as much as possible. But whenever you're talking about the big questions, you get to a point where something is counterintuitive or almost contradictory or paradoxical. And we're going to jump straight into those paradoxes. So Craig, is there anything you'd like to add to define?
Any kind of monism or dualism or any of these philosophies of mind, when taken to their logical conclusion, have absurdity to them. So I feel like what really yokes them all together is that property itself, that no one explanation seems completely adequate, but the variety and the symmetry of the different explanations seems to say something important about consciousness itself.
Right. That absurdity is interesting. I want to make one point from my point of view, from my opinion. I have a lot of respect for the scientific method, but it's just not very helpful when we're talking about the subjective qualia-like aspects of consciousness. Qualia is just a fancy word for sort of the experiential part of our lives, the redness of a red ball.
The raw feels sometimes.
Right, the what is it like of our lives. So unfortunately, it's hard to collect data on qualia. It's an open question whether there's any data or prediction we can make in sort of a scientific sense. We'll explore that, but it seems to me like if we really want to make predictions, like what is it like to be the Earth? What is it like to be IBM Corporation? Do bats feel pain the way we do? If we want to get concrete and, you know, make ethical decisions or tap into the knowledge of other conscious beings, it's hard. It's just speculation.
I think it's more than just hard. I think it's impossible. I don't think we can even tell what it's like to be ourselves to ourselves. What is blue like? If you have no awareness of blue, what's blue like? You know,
Stephen, jump in.
I have a comment on this.
Okay,
for me to ask the question, what is it like to be IBM? In order to know what is it like to be IBM, I would have to be IBM.
Right, which is a pretty strict requirement.
let's say that I were to somehow create a computer program that would create a virtual version, a virtual reality version of IBM, okay? How exact would that, could that simulation be? People like Stephen Wolfram have pointed out in an essay on intractability in physics that the best possible simulation of a system, such as IBM or a hurricane or a whatever physical system one is considering, can only be that physical system itself. So literally, a physical system is it's the best possible simulation of it. So when one asks a question, what is it like to be a bat, such as a paper that Nagel wrote,
hey,
or
Thomas
what's
Lingle.
It like to be IBM, or what's it like to be Craig, what's it like to be Jose, I would literally have to be them to exactly answer that question.
Right.
So what we can draw from that consideration is that at best we can only approximately draw inferences from. We cannot exactly answer those types of questions. We can only have, like, we might know something of what it's like to be IBM or something, but we can never be absolutely sure. Consciousness is a first-person experience,
right,
by definition. Okay, you can't third-person it, as it were.
Right. Well, and it makes me think of, too, the idea that I am more like who I was 5 minutes ago than anything else in the universe, even if you had an identical twin. Even if you had if you were a conjoined twin, you are still more like yourself at any point in your life than anything else is.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think that speaks to just kind of the possibility of uniqueness in the universe, and what does that even mean? You know, what it gets all into pattern recognition, and what does it mean to have something happen once, let alone over and over again? How can you tell that something is happening that's different than everything else that's going on? Whereas a machine doesn't really care. You can train it to recognize one thing over another, but you can tell it, you know, that the sun is the moon and it doesn't care.
At the same time, I believe from our last conversation, we're not going to make this conversation dependent on that conversation, although people can find it at psychtalkradio.com. But I do know from our conversation that you believe that machines still have some kind of experiential existence or perceptual existence, even if it's maybe not as sophisticated as ours, right?
Well, I would say that whatever the machine is made of has some kind of proto-experience or qualia going on. But a machine is an idea that we have about what we've assembled and what we're doing with it for our purposes. So, you know, a television set isn't watching the TV show with you. The pixels are changing. It doesn't know what a pixel is. You know, something like that is, it's a microelectronic experience that's going on. You've got microprocessors that maybe have some experience of holding and releasing current, which is sort of abstract. When we talk about these basic things, charge and current and electromagnetism, we don't really know what they are. We know how they behave. They're just basically patterns that we have observed that matter behaves in, synchronizations of behaviors of matter. And that may be really what they are. That may be that there's not this kind of force field making things happen. It's the things themselves. It's the circuits themselves, the metal, that is having a rhythmic experience of contraction and expansion, holding and releasing of this sort of metallic enthusiasm.
Right.
And we don't know what it's like on there. And, you know, maybe it's fantastic. You know, maybe they're dancing. Who knows? But it doesn't seem like it.
Well, we tend to think it's simpler than us, right?
Yeah.
And why is that? Stephen, too, we would have intuitions about simple versus complex consciousness. What underlies that?
Well, one of the things that we notice about consciousness, and we can see in all of the people that have thought about and written about consciousness, is that there seems to be a wholeness. One of the most important aspects of consciousness is that there is a integral wholeness to it, that it's not a bunch of pieces that somehow bounce off of each other, that it is a whole thing, like blue. Blue is not made up of parts.
Right.
Qualia are always complete wholes. This complete wholeness is something that is quite different.
I was just recently looking up the etymology of words like soul and solitary and solace, that, you know, how it relates to solid, this idea of, you know, it's something where you feel like home, where, you know, you feel that nothing can sort of affect you in a certain way, that this aloneness, and all this is linguistically related to whole and holistic and solar and sun and soul, you know, soul is in being alone and soul is in the soul. So, you know, this is something that's so primal to our experience that we completely take for granted, and but how important it is. You know, can you imagine if you could never be alone, that there was just in your own self, that there was no experience of where you were sort of safe from all of the chaos that you can encounter?
I think we're ready for a thought experiment based on that idea. Okay. What would happen if there was just one human being left and it was the only organism left in the universe? What sort of implications would that have, say, when this being falls asleep?
I'm not of the mind that the universe changes. It's just your view. If you're the last person and you are gone, then the human view of the world is gone.
There's still the television view and the rock view and the earth view and the
right.
whatever else.
Right. But if nothing, if matter had no experience at all and the last living organism was gone, then there couldn't be any universe at all. I think of it that way, that the overlapping of sense is what makes reality.
Well, materialists or physicalists would agree with you too. If there was no stuff, there'd be no universe. The disagreement is what's the stuff made of.
Right. Well, I mean, I'm saying that if there was stuff there, but stuff means just a three-dimensional architecture of volumes occupying space, even if they're doing mechanical things that look like what a brain does or whatever, if there is no experience that goes along with that, then I don't think any of those things, the three-dimensionality of it or the mechanism of it or any of those things could really be said to exist in any way.
So you're saying that's logically impossible? It's not conceivable that there would be
I don't know that it's... I think the problem is that it's not logically impossible, but I think it doesn't make sense. I think it's...
If I might.
Sure.
Let's examine the premise of the question that we're asking. It seems as if we are positing the idea that somehow there is something that it is like to know what the absence of an observer is like.
Right.
That seems on its face a contradiction.
Right.
That
so
is
you
like,
want the observation okay, without the
observer. What kind of experience would I have
right.
if I'm incapable of having experiences?
Right.
Nothing.
Right.
Okay. Blank out.
Yeah. Well, let's imagine we left behind recording instruments, you know, the sort of rulers and barometers and cameras, things that will respond to other physical aspects of the environment. And we would ask, are their measurements going to change? Are orbits of planets and rainfall
going to change? You see, any interaction, in order to be an interaction, has to leave a trace. And it is that leaving a trace that we're dealing with here. The only way you could accomplish what the question seems to require would be to stop all interactions between quote-unquote things. So in that sense, okay, no interaction occurs, no possibility of communication, no possibility of knowledge.
We discussed ahead of time that we would talk about the secret. I think this is a good point to discuss it because are we an integral part of the Earth spinning, or will the Earth spin just fine according to a video camera we leave behind after the zombie apocalypse that will still record, you know, the sky changing every night or whatever?
Well, let's consider this. Okay, we're considering a property of rotation.
Right, and are we causing it?
Okay, now how could we be causing it? What is it about ourselves that causes this effect? That does on its face doesn't seem to make any sense. On the other hand, let's ask ourselves about how is it that I know about the property of rotation? If I never experienced anything like rotation ever, would I have any idea what it might be? Answer is no. Now, if I'm just considering one individual, and this individual has, you know, a set of experiences that amongst which there's nothing like rotation, then for that individual, nothing, whatever, have that property. Now, okay, now does that say anything about the about something spinning in and of itself? No. I think that the entire idea that our perception of a thing causes the thing is premised on a lot of ambiguity. Right. That,
and I think that the key to that is levels, or what I have been calling castes, that we're just kind of the tip of the iceberg of this entire entity that's our body and our life, and it extends mm-hmm. out, you know, to a context of our species and biology and this planet and geophysical, you know, timescales and all of this, so that our thoughts are not on the same level as these gigantic patterns with a momentum of billions of years behind them. It's the same thing in one level, but not directly the same thing. You can't just, you know, I mean, you do have direct control over your own hands and arms, you know, that's real. So that's enough. As long as you're yourself, as long as you're a human being, you have powers and senses appropriate for a human being.
But they're limited.
They're limited, but they evolve and they expand, and you can, people are born with different strengths and weaknesses, and, you know, you can amplify those in cultural groups. And so it's, you know, there's some plasticity there. But yeah, I mean, there are some major themes that are going to be hard to go against as being and still be what we are.
So far, your accounts for my questions have not strayed too far from a materialist's intuition. So a materialist's intuition would be that the secret is BS. And
well, the problem with it is it's not 100% BS. That's the that's unfortunately, if people go down that road and get into affirmations and or any kind of spiritual path, the universe will seem to support that. And in a sense, it does.
But I would say it's the principles of psychology, of believing in yourself and having confidence and so forth.
Well, I think it goes even, it is that, and but that works for a reason. I think that what happens is that people will get into this stuff and they'll see that it does seem to go beyond that more, that you'll, you know, your enthusiasm level opens doors and opportunities, not just on the mechanical level that you would imagine that it would have to, you know, but weird things happen, you know, new things that have never happened to you could happen before. But that can be a sort of leading you down this dangerous path that ultimately can lead to delusion and mania and, you know, a lot of actually dangerous stuff, cults and things, because there is this charismatic potential within each of us. And if you have no fear, you know, you can unleash the giant within. But you may find that once you've done that, the person who released it isn't there anymore to tell you what it is that you thought you wanted, or what, you know, you're not yourself anymore. So now what are you? If you
okay,
take
so I was
screen.
I was oversimplifying. Maybe it's not the complete alignment, a complete dismissal of the secret,
right,
but maybe a dismissal of its more extreme claims.
Well, the secret and a lot of those things, I think the only major problem is mistaking subjective experiences for objective experiences.
Might I touch on that?
Sure.
for a moment? The first thing we have to understand is that we cannot just consider our own minds, our own mind, because it's not just about me, to put it in a phrase.
So what else is at play in constructing consciousness or the universe?
Everyone else involved. All of the things, all the other interactions that are involved. Like, for example, there is some consideration of whether or not the moon is there when we're not looking at it. Now, exactly what would that mean, not looking at it? Who's not looking at it? Who might not be looking at it? Who might be looking at it? What is that really all about? I see it as we have potentially a huge and maybe even an infinite number of quote-unquote things interacting with each other. And to try to boil things down to just a few of those and to focus in on just the interactions of a few things and try to blank out, you know, everything else, but then assume that everything carries on, right, is a mistake.
Right. That was a conversation between Niels Bohr and Albert Einstein, right? I think you were telling me that before about whether the moon is there. So it's not just for our listeners who are saying, these guys are kooks. This is something physicists would actually wonder about in their more philosophical moments.
This becomes a real question because quantum mechanics, and when you study it, it seems to imply some very strange things, such as what you measure depends on how you make the measurement. And so that, and it's, it becomes rather difficult to sustain the usual realist view of things, that is, that that objects have properties completely independent of me. What we have to understand is that what we know of something depends completely on our ability to measure those things. I can't talk about how much a ball might weigh if I'm not capable of measuring the weight of that ball. I can't talk about what color is the tree if I'm not capable of sensing in some way or finding out by somebody else's sense what the color is. So it's really about what actually can be measured. Like, for example, the Heisenberg uncertainty relationship tells us, is basically telling us that you cannot measure position and momentum in the same object simultaneously, because measuring one,
accuracy,
measuring
right.
the position disturbs the ability to measure the momentum, and measuring the momentum disturbs the ability to measure the position. So you can't extract both position data and momentum data simultaneously.
And then also, I think the other way is our psyche is so has so many layers that they all don't know what each other are doing all the time, so that you may have senses that your executive center of your psyche is aware of. You know, that sort of intuition is sort of thinking that you might know something. You know, how does that really work?
It's interesting, but there seem to be criteria of what the particular content of sense is.
Right. Yes, it matters. It doesn't matter to a machine. So, you know, you take an MP3 file, the computer doesn't care if you change the extension to JPEG and look at it visually. Mm-hmm. It makes no difference to the computer at all. It's the same data. But to a person, you can't even tell what song it is, even if it's your favorite song, if you're just looking at a picture of the data. So to us, the channels of sense are a really big deal.
We'll get back to this idea of computers being dumb and sense as this more complicated consciousness. And we'll also get back to quantum mechanics and physics and consciousness. But I want to talk about time for a moment, time perception. And now I want to start from the psychological angle, which is, for example, the experiments by David Eagleman, that when you drop someone down a really scary roller coaster, they will tell you at the bottom, that felt like 10 seconds.
Right.
And you measure it with a watch standing on the ground, and it was 3 seconds.
Right.
And what's happening is memory dilation of the time. They, because their emotional system, their fight or flight is triggered so strongly, they take a much more detailed snapshot of every moment falling down, and they use all that detail on the way down as an approximation of how much time elapsed. And what this gets at is not just time, but the unreliability of our minds to correspond to some objective reality. So let's explain why that happens.
Well, that's interesting, and I like that experiment too, that they actually had the stopwatches to a hundredth of a second or whatever, and that they would click it going down to test if really, you know, is time changing? Is being scared, does it actually change how fast your watch is going, you know? And of course, you know, they found out that no, it doesn't. It just seems like that. But it's the thing is that a stopwatch has no sense of the intensity, the emotional intensity of a moment. So it's not just you. It's not just that, oh, I'm deluded. I think that time's flying, but or, you know, slowing down, but it's really not. Well, the time that we experience is not really watch time anyway. A watch is a completely different... our idea of time is a normalization of different rhythms of material objects. It's just standardized. It's clocks and calendars are not real. They're maps of regular repeating patterns that we've observed in nature. You know, we are the keepers of the calendars and the clocks. We tell the time. So the time is really, you know, our experience of time is really the more, the richer experience, the richer qualia. So if you're with a group of people and you're all scared out of your mind, And it all, to all of you, when the elevator is plummeting down 30 stories, seems like it took a half hour. That's real. That's the reality. It has to do with significance. It's the moment is more saturated with feeling, with qualia, as you're saying. You know, because you're sampling more with adrenaline rushing. Your brain is picking up more impressions per second, perhaps. But the main thing is that they're deeper.
You just used the word per second, so you still believe in some kind of objective time that's helpful. The GPS time and the atomic clock are some kind of useful reference.
Absolutely, sure. I mean, they're useful for the world of our body. You know,
we always have to have a standard when we're any time that we're talking about measurements, because what we're doing is we're comparing one thing to another.
Right.
When we talk about length, we're comparing some unknown length quantity to some known standard length.
Right.
Is something a foot long, less than a foot long, more than a foot long? Is it a meter? Is it a millimeter? So a measurement is essentially a process of comparing a standard to an unknown.
And you yourself always have to have the ultimate sort of prime standard, even if you don't think of it that way. The measurer is the ultimate point of reference.
Now, it's interesting. Even mainstream physics says that we don't really have absolute standard references, that it depends on how fast one object's moving relative to another, how long it'll be. If there's a plane flying around the Earth really fast, it'll be longer relative to the Earth than it would be if it were still on the Earth. And this is all Einsteinian physics, from what I can tell.
Relativity,
and this is all in the textbooks.
Yes.
The same thing with time, too. If that plane's moving really fast, anyone who's in it is not going to seem to age as fast. They'll come back down and all their relatives will be old.
Their clocks would tick slower as it were. All of this is dependent on the relationships between electric and magnetic fields. I don't want to get off into the detail, but I would invite whoever is interested in this to go to their library and look for books on relativity. If you could find the actual book that Einstein wrote on relativity, go straight to the source and reason through the thought experiments that Einstein and others have discussed. And the point is that relativity is actually about things that are not relative, such as the speed of light. And what's interesting is that the speed of light is we tend to think of it as if it were a state of movement, but it is not.
Right.
It is not. It is a relationship. It is a ratio of the permeability to the permittivity of space. It's a relationship between magnetic and electric fields.
I think of it even as not really about light at all, but it's about the latency of space, basically.
Yeah.
It's the minimum latency of space.
What do you mean by latency?
Well, latency, delay that if you try to signal across a distance in space, that if it's, a light year away, if it's 186,000 whatever miles away, then it's going to take... the latency is going to be a year of any kind of signal.
Another way of thinking of it is like bandwidth.
Yeah.
How many packets can you send through a channel?
Right.
There is a maximum amount.
Right. And I like to, think of E equals MC squared. So C, say, is the speed of light, but C is actually just the maximum velocity of anything. It happens to be related to light and what... because light is energy, basically, that C is, I would call it absolute velocity, that it's where you have stillness, and then you'd have, so stillness would be something is at the same position over time. Motion would be if something is at different positions over time. And then this C, or absolute velocity, would be basically it's at any position or no position over time.
What I really want to do is tease apart the materialism versus idealism debate.
Ultimately, the speed of light is about connection between things, the notion of a maximal connection between things. Let's focus on the notion of a thing. Is consciousness a thing? Perhaps it is not a thing at all. Perhaps it is a process.
Right.
And as a process, there isn't anything that is conserved about it other than... if the conditions for the process occur, then the process will occur. If the conditions for the process do not occur, then the process does not obtain.
And I would say that, you know, maybe it's not only a process, that it's the process. All processes are some kind of experience. It may be not the experience that you think. I don't think Bugs Bunny is having an experience of eating a carrot. But, you know, there's different levels of presentation and representation that is part of this process. And that really is the process, is presentation and representation.
Steve?
Some people have like Charles Sanders Peirce, yeah, have speculated that perhaps consciousness is ultimately the act of making a difference, or the process of distinguishing.
Right. So both. That's what I think of sense and motive, that this kind of input, output, afferent or efferent modes of what we could call sense or process or whatever, awareness.
What I've been working on is I've been studying the work of Von Pratt, emeritus professor of computer science at Stanford, and where he proposed a form of dualism or a rehabilitation of dualism based on this idea of process, where mind and body are distinct processes, that they are related in that processes of mind can be characterized in terms of logic, and processes of body can be characterized as physical stuff. And what he noticed was that the mathematical representations of each of these two have a known relationship known as the stone duality. This comes from the work of Marshall Stone, who noticed that Boolean algebras have an exact correspondence in topology as a totally disconnected compact Hausdorff space. Forgive the technical details, but anybody that's interested in this can Google the Stone representation theorem, and they can read up on it themselves. It's a quite detailed concept, and there's a lot involved. The point here is that there are alternatives to idealism and materialism.
Obviously, we're not going to get into the math too much, but I want to ask why it's relevant. So we have mind and body processes. Can we say anything significant about the mind in terms of equations or the body in terms of equations that can actually be linked in a coherent way? Is that what you're saying the Stone representation theorem is helping us do?
Yes. Yes. We always have objects and, you know, the physics stuff and representations of the objects. The way I think of it is that for any given object, there's at least one representation, and for any given representation, there's at least one object.
Well, see, I think that the objects are, from an absolute perspective, the objects are the representation, that the subjects, that, you know, are the contents of our experience is a presentation, and within that experience, there's our body and the outside world, and those are representations. They're still presentations, but they're also representations of a lot of different worlds and things going on.
Wait, be more clear there. Representations of what?
Of what it is. So it's kind of like you. If you are a book, you're a story. Say, you know, you're writing your own book. It's a book that has some stuff written in it, and then you can add to it, and you can go back and change it. You're this story that's evolving, and you're outside of you. You can see that you have a spine, and a cover.
This is a metaphor, to be clear.
Exactly.
We're not talking about you are Lolita.
Yeah. And you know, but then the universe would be a library where you can only see the outsides of the books, the spines of all these different books. And you might be able to read the titles, and you might be able to get closer to one of them and really kind of get a feel of what it might be about and everything. But you can't get outside of your own book, you know, into these other things. So this world of objects is, I'm thinking, is actually more of the representation. Because the reality is that each one of those books is a whole universe of experiences and history and all kinds of things going on. Mm-hmm. And you only really have your own with that depth, that longitudinal depth that runs through time instead of across space. I mean, we're complicated, so we've got stuff happening simultaneously too. But if you wanted to really boil it down and sort of stereotype it, our experience is time, and the world that we experience through our lives is space. You know.
Now, what about different part-whole interactions? I feel like we can group together almost anything, an infinite number of things, sort of combinatorially, if that's the right word, and say, well, that's some kind of set of things that has its own experience. For example, Donald Trump's hair, you know, like, does it have its own experience as a collective that's different from the experience of each individual hair and the experience of the skin on Donald Trump's face, which is different from the experience of the whole skin of his body? You see how we can think of like infinite number of groupings of things?
But then, and when we think of it though, that's, we're not even really thinking of the reality of actual threads that are growing out of this human being's hair or head or whatever. This is a caricature. This is a cartoon of what we think that we know about. We've experienced representations of representations.
But Donald Trump exists, right? His hair and his skin exist.
Well, there's a human being that exists with that name, but he's not what you've seen in all... You know, you think you know him, and maybe to some extent you do, because you've seen these images and appearances in the media and stuff. But, you know, think of your own appearances in photographs or online or whatever. Is that you, really?
So what are the objective characteristics of Donald Trump that would exist in the absence of any other organism to observe him? And he was only interacting with light and other inanimate things.
Well, it depends what scale. If you're 1,000 miles away, he's just a speck. If you're a dust mite on his ear, then he's a whole universe of, you know.
All that is, yeah. You see, the word objective here presents an ambiguity, because it is as if you're trying to see things from no particular scale and from no particular direction and with no particular bias. Eventually, you run into the problem of, how can I see anything at all?
Can't different scales agree with each other, or they complement each other?
There are. Well, that's part of the sense.
Well, I think the idea would be, is what is it that acts to integrate all of these things into a whole? What we're really considering here is been studied under the title mirology, which is how do we collect things into wholes and how do we segregate wholes into parts?
What was that word?
Partition up the relationship between wholes and parts.
Mirology.
I didn't hear the ology. One more time?
Mariology. Mereology.
Mariology. Okay.
We assume a lot of things about... There is a paradox known as... I think it's called the Sorites paradox, where when is a heap not a heap? Say I have a heap of grains of wheat or a heap of sand, and I take away one grain, is it still a heap? Do I take another grain away, is it still a heap? What if I get down to 3 grains of sand? Is it still a heap?
Right.
Well, my question is not, is it a heap, but is it a different consciousness?
Well, again, consciousness requires one of the things that seems to be a consensus and an agreement is that consciousness requires even a wholeness. The consciousness isn't a part of something. We don't experience anything piecewise. We experience whole. I have, when I'm experiencing myself, it's not as if I have something of what it's like to be an arm plus something what it's like to be an ear plus something what it's like to be experiencing, you know, seeing a monitor. It's one whole.
Well, you don't have what it's like to be your ear, but how do we know your ear doesn't have what it's like to be an ear?
Well, right, because...
How would we answer the question?
Yeah, well, I think that we can't, but that there are these themes. Holes look like nucleated spheres, you know? They look like continuous, like a worm, you know? There's just kind of hints, and they may be wrong, but I think there's a natural, this kind of caste system of the universe, that every level of reality seems to have its active agent. So we talk about atoms. The atom is kind of the star. There's a whole lot of things going on that level, but, you know, if we had to make a guess at what, if there is consciousness on that level, that, yeah, it might be atoms do that. Or maybe it's a molecule as a whole, and the atoms aren't aren't really real in the sense that we might think that we that they are, you know.
Well, the reason I'm pushing this is because you two are at least sympathetic to what is called panpsychism, which is another name for, which is related to idealism, that there is some psychic experiential quality to everything. We talked about TVs already. But so I'm just trying to push it to its logical limits. If TVs can have experience, can't
See, that's the problem of it's we think of a TV, but that's just a character in our story. The TV, there is no TV there.
Well, why aren't we characters in the TV story? See, I don't.
Well, because the TV is not really there. I mean, there's a box there. It doesn't know it's a box. You know, there's sheets of polymer molecules. But I mean, still, that's our description of it.
Yeah, well,
but,
we have to distinguish what the names of things from the things.
Right, but still, you know. If we hadn't fashioned it into a TV, what would be there? You know, what?
Well, there would be the possibility of something else.
Right, but I mean, there'd be those materials would be around. You'd have petroleum and iron and copper and stuff. And
perhaps, yes.
So, you know, that at least in my mind has more of a chance of having some reality to it. Like I always use the example of the trash can in a fast food restaurant that says "thank you" stamped onto the plastic lid, you know. So I don't think anybody's suggesting that the lid is being polite, you know, that the lid knows what that means or anything like that.
But it just seems sort of anthropomorphic to me. We're taking human experience and saying a TV doesn't have human experience, therefore we're not as interested in experience. I mean, because the information theorist, the materialist would say, well, we can talk about how the circuits in the TV don't carry such complicated functional states. They don't exchange and respond to information the same way as human brains do, and that's why something's different.
But as Stephen was saying, that, you know, it's not the complexity alone, it's the simplicity, it's the wholeness. That's what's missing. That, you know, if you look at a tiny insect, they do some pretty amazing things. You know, you could have the entire internet, all of the computers of the internet put together may have a lot more computing power than a flea, but the flea still seems likely to have this consciousness, this awareness. But I think it's just really hard because we look at everything through so much of a human filter. I mean, just when you look at language, when you look at English written, you don't see nonsense characters that you have to translate into English under most
people.
Well, yeah, most people most of the time. But once you learn English, and if you're in a coherent state of mind, you can look at those letters and they appear to you as already meaningful. They're already read for you.
Well, so I agree that there's a certain simplicity and wholeness and continuity to consciousness. And a lot of people notice this, Buddhist meditators, William James, the American psychologist, lots of people. However, how do we account for the diversity of minds that can allow for a person to develop alexia after a stroke? They're no longer able to make sense of English, even though they can still see that the ink is black. Or it could even be more selective. I'm pretty sure there are cases where they only can't make sense of a language they used to know, their second language, but they still can make sense of their first language. Right. There can be such specific deficits in every possible way.
Absolutely.
That, I mean, every component of seeing the black text can be distorted. Like maybe a person might not have good depth perception anymore after an eye operation. And so they can see a flat page just fine, but if there's text written on a ball, all of a sudden they have trouble making sense of it because it's three-dimensional.
Right. Or they could make sense out of it through one eye, but not the other.
Yep.
I think those are questions that a neuroscientist would address. What we're talking about there is like, okay, we think of our brains as basically pattern recognition machines. And to really answer a lot of these questions, we have to say, okay, what is going on in our heads? Fundamentally, if we don't have a brain, if there's not a physical activity occurring, there is no thought there, ultimately. So the materialists make a very good point. But the problem is how does a pure materialist consider meaning? What is meaningfulness? What is intention? What is aboutness?
Well, let me give just a little bit of name dropping. So there's this idea of epiphenomenalism, mm-hmm. Sometimes related to property dualism, just the mm-hmm. idea that there are physical interactions, functional states in the brain. Out of that, as some kind of byproduct, we have these mental properties. So there's some physical substrate or requirement that, mm-hmm. that's necessary and sufficient for the consciousness, but the consciousness mm-hmm. is just caused by something else, and it doesn't cause anything else. But that's a little counterintuitive too. It's like the soul floating above the physical processes, right?
The difficulty with that is that it makes mind a completely causally ineffective thing.
Which, and when you do that, it makes, if materialism has to make sense in a materialist way, then something that exists that is not causally effective sort of cancels it out. How do you have an epiphenomenon? What's an epiphenomenon doing in a materialist universe?
What's the point of it? Right. Why is it?
And how is it? If it's not a material, then what is it?
Yeah. Well, the why question is interesting, but does it need an answer? Does it need a reason to be there? Can it just be part of the laws of physics?
Right now, I have a thought that I'm in a room talking on the phone with some guys, and this is being recorded, etc.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, the things that I say assume certain things are true. Certain physical configurations are true. If I were to believe something completely different, then I would possibly not even be speaking, or I would be talking to somebody else. I would be doing different things. So the point here is, how could something that is epiphenomena have such an agency effect? How can it make decisions, as it were, can decide, okay, my mouth is going to move this way instead of that way?
But see, that's not really a problem, because agency can be accounted for in the brain's activity in a purely physical sense. I think for me, the counterintuitive part is that more, why is the sparkle and magic as some kind of add-on to the agency in the brain? Why aren't we just zombies? Okay. The Chalmers thought experiment.
I think David Chalmers really did all of us a lot of service by thinking about this. If it's epiphenomena or an illusion or whatever it is that Daniel C. Dennett calls it, why bother having it to begin with? Why bother? Why even have the illusion? Right. What point does it serve? What?
Well, and then the hypocrisy, I think, of starting out saying, you know, I'm a materialist, I'm a skeptic, you know, we can explain all of this in terms of epiphenomenon. And then, but then you wind up saying with this kind of completely metaphysical never-never land that epiphenomena lives in, that has no weight or substance or value or reason for being anywhere. And I think that hypocrisy and the denial of that hypocrisy really shows the intention behind materialism, that we want this certainty. We want to jump. We don't really want to understand consciousness if it's going to be weird and scary. You know, we just want it to look like how it looks to us. Even though it's an improvement over naive realism, it's just a sophisticated realism.
You know? Sometimes it seems that we're more interested in having the appearance of being able to explain things than actually being able to explain things.
Right. Well, going back to we were talking about the brain as a pattern recognition machine or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I think of it more as what it seems like it is. It's a community of living organisms. Each neuron.
Minsky's Society of Mind idea is very good with regard to that.
Marvin Minsky.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean it, but the thing is that on the outside it looks like cells, a brain in space, but on the inside it scales up very differently. So we don't feel like 100 billion neurons at all. We feel like ourselves, just a single entity or whatever.
This is what Leibniz recognized and elaborated in his monadology.
Okay.
The idea of a monad is the inside experience of things.
Right.
As instead of thinking of atoms, which involves an out exterior voyeuristic point of view, we have as our ontological primitives the perception of being. I'm experiencing myself as, and that is taken as the primitive. So we have this inside outside relation.
Right.
So that atoms are an external point of view, and monads are the internal point of view. So basically, the idea here is the possibility that the relationship between mind and body is an inside-outside relationship.
And that matter and experience in general, I mean, I think that's my kind of metaphysical extension of it, is that that's going on everywhere. Wherever you see matter, there is some... that you're seeing a snapshot, like Flatland. You know, if you've seen that Flatland, the idea of that a two-dimensional universe, that if it a creature in a two-dimensional universe, if it experienced a cube or something passing through his universe, that you'd see these slices, you know, larger and larger, smaller and smaller slices of the three-dimensional object, but would never get the whole object all at once. So I feel like that's what matter and space is. It's a snapshot of a moment. You know, we have sort of the opposite. We have an axis of a stationary axis, the eye of the hurricane of an experience of time. But outside of us is just the opposite, is this kind of Cartesian grid of, you know, objects.
Hey, Craig and Stephen, we're coming up short on time. We have about 2 or 3 minutes, and I have one question I really wanted to ask, and I think both of you will have an interesting answer.
Okay.
So it's about God and the divine and all that. Gottfried Leibniz was interested in pantheism, the idea that there's some kind of God everywhere. You mentioned his monadology and monads as being these sort of elements of mind or experience, the inside out of atoms. And then we have another idealist who's similar to your points of view is Immanuel Kant. He also believed in some sort of God. And so I'm wondering what listeners would think that we haven't mentioned any sort of God or deity or anything in this discussion. Where might that fit in your worldviews, or why would you discount a God?
I discount the idea, first of all, of any sort of anthropomorphic notion of a God, for the simple reason that...
Why would God have a penis?
The idea here is that in order to have wholeness in the type that we have, you have to have non-contradiction. You have to, all of your facts have to agree. But from the an entity that had all that had simultaneously all points of view, that would be one massive contradiction. How can you have the point of view of looking from above, from below, looking from the side?
And I think that you can by shattering it into time, that you a diffraction, the big diffraction. You shatter through time and you divide across space, or you know, divide and multiply by masking the wholeness of yourself.
The point is there cannot be a single entity that had all points of view at the same time. It's so that kind of puts the kibosh on the idea of that voyeuristic view from outside of the universe. It shows that it's a logical contradiction.
And I think too that if you look at you know, theism and the history of mythology and religion, that what you find is that it's about the descriptions of God is a lot like the descriptions of imagination or consciousness itself, that it's sort of unbound. It just, you know, it's omniscient, it's omnipotent. So it's a superlative. It's a projection of our interiority, you know, the potential that we experience, that, you know, but we want it exteriorized. We want it, you know, something that we don't. Yeah. So we don't have to do it ourselves. You know, we want to say that this perfection must exist already, and, you know, it kind of gets us off the hook.
Right. Craig, we're going to have to leave you with the last word there because we're out of time, unfortunately. But it sounds like we're going to have to do this again.
Anytime. That'd be great.
Great. Awesome. You've been listening to Psych Talk on WCOM. Our website is psychtalkradio.com, psychtalkradio.com, where we'll have this podcast up. Our guests speaking about consciousness have been Craig Weinberg of multisensorealism.com and Stephen King, an independent researcher contributing his insights on time and philosophy, and a member of online discussion groups that tackle the big philosophical questions.